Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Two-thirds of Americans said they got at least some of their news from social media, according to an August 2017 survey from the Pew Research Center. The way companies like Twitter and Facebook prioritize what users see affects what they believe and what they share. False news spreads far more rapidly on Twitter than real news, according to a new study by three MIT scholars who studied a decade of tweets. The spread of false information is not due to bots. It's actually due to people sharing inaccurate news items. And the same thing happens on Facebook. There's a lot of pressure right now on social media companies to be clear about its policies and also what it deems a legitimate news service. But a lot of money is at stake. The Motley Fool reports that over the past year, Facebook's revenue grew to $13 billion. That's up 42% over last year. And mobile advertising revenue grew to almost $12 billion, up 50% over last year. So joining us to talk about how social media is changing the news and the role that profits play are two guests. Dr. Claire Wardle is co-founder of First Draft, a nonprofit at the Harvard University's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. First Draft focuses on addressing misinformation and disinformation. And Claire Wardle joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Claire. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Ryan Mack is a senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed News based in San Francisco, and he extensively writes about these issues. In fact, one of the stories that he recently wrote, you might want to check out, it's called "Congratulations, Mr. President. Zuckerberg, Facebook's CEO Mark Zuckerberg, secretly called Trump after the election." And we'll talk with Ryan about that. Hi, Ryan. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, I want to start off by asking both of you how you think Facebook affected the election. There was a project called Project Alamo out of Texas, and they gathered a lot of data about voters. The Trump campaign spent $85 million on Facebook. This is according to a BBC report. That's most of its budget. And Teresa Hong was one of the brains behind Trump's digital election campaign. And she told the BBC that without Facebook, we wouldn't have won. Ryan, obviously there's no way to know this, but what do you think about what she told the BBC?
I mean, I think when you kind of assess an election after the fact, the winning side always wants to kind of beat their chest and talk about the winning strategy. In this case, the Trump campaign heavily relied on Facebook with its ad buying. We saw that with campaign expenditure forms, as well as just talking to some of the folks that worked in the campaign, Brad Parscale, who headed up digital for the campaign, Gary Kobe, another one. And they all spoke about how effective they were able to leverage Facebook's tools, mainly the advertising, to kind of get their message out to voters that were kind of susceptible to the messaging that they were testing at the time.
And what would you add, Claire?
I mean, the difficulty is it's very hard to measure this. So were Facebook ads actually changing people's minds? Were they actually encouraging people to get out to vote if they weren't otherwise going to do that? Were they suppressing the vote? Were they actually giving people false information to say, you know, you should stay at home? And so the difficulty here is it's impossible for us to really understand the impact of Facebook, partly because we can't really get data out of Facebook and cross-reference it with user behavior. So it's a black box in terms of trying to research this, but it's a huge question, something that we need to know. There is some evidence that when Facebook, I think it was 2011, actually, you know, allowed people to say, "I voted," if that appeared on people's news feeds, it did drive up people's likelihood to go out to vote. So there is some empirical evidence that what happens on Facebook does make a real life difference. We just know very little about the specifics.
Right. And clearly, Facebook made a lot of money from the Trump campaign. And Ryan, you report that in the days following Trump's election victory, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg placed a secret, previously unreported call to Donald Trump. Sources told you that he congratulated the Trump team on its victory and the successful campaign. What did you learn?
Yeah, I would like to caveat that first by saying I think in most elections, it's not that unusual for a high-powered executive, a world leader, to call the winner of the U.S. election and congratulate them. In this case, it was interesting because of the messaging that had gone on before the election. Mark Zuckerberg kind of spoke, not specifically about Trump, but he spoke against the idea of building walls in a very kind of famous speech at a Facebook conference. He spoke against some of Trump's policies. And meanwhile, he goes and kind of calls the president right after the election happens to congratulate them and the campaign, congratulate him on kind of running a successful campaign. And so that was kind of the interesting we found about that. In addition to that story, that story also mentions the fact that internally at Facebook, the company kind of used the Trump campaign as a successful example of how to use the advertising tools to your favor, how to leverage a successful message, how to get your message out there. And the Trump campaign was really used as a key example of Facebook advertising working for its clients.
And I bring this up to start the show because so much money is at stake. So, Claire, if the Trump campaign spent $85 million on Facebook, spent most of its budget on Facebook, according to the BBC, and we're seeing that their revenue is just exploding. Just this year alone, their revenue grew to $13 billion, up 42% over last year. And mobile ads, so the ads we see on our cell phones, grew to almost $12 billion, up 50% over last year. With so much money at stake, what can we expect these companies to do to crack down on all of the false news that's being spread?
So I think the first thing I'd say is that many people think about Facebook as a kind of a communication platform, but actually it's the most sophisticated marketing platform we've ever had. Previously, if I was trying to sell something, I might buy some space on the side of a London bus or a billboard on the size of an interstate. But I could never really tell who was going to look at that advertisement. The reason that Facebook is so powerful is because if I'm an advertiser, I can look at my Facebook data and say, I specifically want to target women between 18 and 21 who enjoy tennis and love Justin Bieber and last week traveled to New York. I mean, you can be so specific that it's the most powerful marketing tool out there, which is why they are making as much money as they are doing. And I think it's very easy to say they're deliberately not cracking down because they're making so much money. And I think, you know, that we have to recognize that. We have to understand that shareholders are putting pressure on Facebook every single day to make more money. But we also have to recognize there are people internally at the company trying to improve the level of pollution in their streams. They're trying to think about this problem. But we can't deny that the people who are trying to solve this are in a commercial company who are tasked with making money, and their bonuses every quarter are, you know, designed based on how much more money, you know, how much money they bought into the company. So it's very hard for them to think about how does this improve the public square? How does this improve our discourse when ultimately all of their metrics are designed around making more money? So it's a really complicated relationship.
Right. And Claire, a lot of our listeners do not use social media. So can you explain the correlation between Facebook profits and false information being shared?
So one thing I'd say about information that travels on social networks is that what works is pieces of information that people have emotional responses to. So firstly, if I'm on Facebook and I'm making a decision about what to share, I'm thinking through my own identity. You know, I perform on Facebook. The reason Facebook is social is because I'm thinking through who will see this, what do I want them to think about me, which is why I'm going to post pictures of me looking, you know, beautiful or on holiday or having fun. But in the area of false news or misinformation, we tend to share information that we have an emotional response to that tends to reinforce our worldview. So when we think about this space, a lot of this isn't 100% false. It's misleading. It's the kind of information that somebody has maybe stretched a statistic or has actually, you know, created a more sensational headline. So as a user on Facebook, I'm going to post that stuff because I'm performing. I believe this, whether it's about anti-vaccination or whether it's a view on abortion or a social issue like gun control. People tend to perform. And so those people who are trying to spread misinformation recognize that and will produce memes, visuals, false articles that reinforces those kind of ideas and people's emotional relationship to information.
Hmm. Ryan, what would you add?
I would encourage people to read my colleague's coverage of this. Craig Silverman has done great coverage of this. And I mean, I would totally agree. I mean, some of this information is tested and wired so that it kind of hits the pleasure centers of the brain, so that you kind of share those things, you send it to your friends, and it's much more enticing to share that, much more sexy to share that than a real article or real news, and that's a huge problem.
Claire, the study involving Twitter by three MIT scholars who looked at a decade of tweets say that the reason why falsehoods spread more quickly than the truth is because people tend to share more negative than positive news. What do you think about that? Is that what other research also finds?
Yeah, I think something we have to remember here is that, yes, we're talking about relatively new forms of technology, but they're really just reflecting us as humans. And so anthropologists have showed that the way that gorillas connect with each other is that they pick insects and lice off each other's fur. As humans, we don't have fur, so the way that we connect is gossip. And what we have to remember is, if somebody calls me up and says, Claire, you're not going to believe it, David's having an affair, do I fact check that? No, I probably pick up the phone and tell my other friend that somebody's having an affair. So we are hardwired to kind of connect with other people in this way. So the types of information we share are things that other people don't know, things that make us frightened, things that make us happy, things that make us angry. And so that's what we have to think about here, is in that Twitter study, surprise, surprise, people share false information. But when you actually look at those, they tend to be stories that resonate on an emotional level with people. And when something resonates on an emotional level, we are much less likely to be critical. Our brains are a lot less likely to kick in and do the necessary checks. We share while standing in line with our mobile phone. We quickly share on Twitter without thinking, because there's a part of our brain that has just said, oh my God, I'm angry, or I'm fearful, or I'm happy or sad. And that's us as humans connecting with other humans.
And I would stress, it's just so much easier to do it on Twitter. You can just hit the like button. You can easily hit the retweet button. You can retweet with a small comment. It just makes it so much easier, and it's an accelerant to spreading that type of information, simply because you just saw it on Twitter, you just believe it. And it's just that much easier to spread on that platform.
And also, people share articles without even reading the article. They just share based on what the headline says, right?
Because
we have data that shows that.
Absolutely, we're performing. Right. I used to work for the UN Refugee Agency, and it was quite clear all the time, people were sharing our stories because they wanted to look like the sorts of people that cared about refugees, but they weren't reading the story. All of this is psychological. That's how we have to understand this.
And so, I mean, we could probably do another show on this issue, but what is this doing to the way we process information and what we believe? Because, you know, I think about the days when we had three networks, maybe we got one newspaper, you went to the grocery store and people were talking about 60 Minutes, and for the most part, people saw the same news. And those days are long gone. And so, Claire, what does this say about our belief system, what we tend to believe, the news outlets that we tend to flock to?
So it's partly because our brains are overwhelmed. I mean, we know now, I think on average, we look at our phones 50 times a day. I mean, the amount of information we're receiving every day, is our brains are overloaded. And so our brains are looking for heuristics, these mental shortcuts that help us make sense of information. So, you know, if I used to go to a newsstand and give somebody some money and bought a newspaper, my brain would say, this is news. Or I'd listen to the radio and I'd hear the bongs, the BBC, and I'd be like, oh, this is news. Now, if I'm on Facebook, I get news, I'm using bunny ears, that a friend is pregnant, another friend is on holiday, and there's been a Syrian chemical weapons attack, all looking identical on my Facebook newsfeed. So our brains are working really, really hard. So that's why we're overwhelmed. And that's why research shows we're tending to trust those people that we know. You know, in the absence of gatekeepers, we're tending to move into spaces, whether that's closed messaging apps or back to email or groups with people that we are showing that we're trusting one another. And so the conversations about the trust in media declining, that's what's so worrying. It's not that people are losing trust in everything. They're tending to trust those around them. And that's social media, is that. What if my best friend shares something on Facebook, I'm more likely to believe it. And that's, we have to have that conversation about, how do we help our brains understand what's trusted, you know, who's actually done professional journalistic work and double source something and has a corrections policy. That's what we're struggling with now. We haven't developed the heuristics for these new social platforms.
Right. And it doesn't help when the man in the White House continually talks about fake news. It just adds to all of this. Ryan, what would you add?
As a user of these platforms, I just feel completely inundated sometimes. I actually did a panel on this at Twitter for the company in front of its employees. And I told them basically, sometimes you just have to delete the app. I've started deleting the app from my phone on the weekends because sometimes I just feel so overwhelmed by the amount of news. And it's funny because that's my job, to stay on top of these things. And it's almost impossible. It's whether that's on Facebook or on Twitter, whatever platform you use, you just feel overwhelmed these days with the amount of it.
Ryan Mack is a senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed News based in San Francisco, and he writes about technology. Dr. Claire Wardle is co-founder of First Draft, a nonprofit at the Harvard University's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. And today we are talking about how false news is spread online on companies, through companies like Twitter and Facebook. And if you'd like to join us, do you have any questions about the advertising, the promoted content or the news that you see in your timelines or your feeds? What questions do you have about how content ends up on your screen? Because if you've got thousands of friends on Facebook, there's no possible way you're seeing everything. Facebook determines who pops up in your feed. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And what do you think social media companies should do about this with so much at stake? Because their profits continue to grow, especially when it comes to ad revenue that we see on our cell phones and other digital devices. 866-798-8255. And if you work for one of these companies, we'd love to hear from you. You can be anonymous if you'd like. Ryan actually wrote a piece about Facebook Chief Security Officer Alex Stamos, who left Facebook, and he sent a memo saying that we need to be willing to pick sides. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about who is making these decisions. Claire, when Facebook hired Campbell Brown to head its news partnerships to do damage control, it got quite a lot of attention. The New York Times had a pretty lengthy piece about Campbell Brown, who is a former CNN and NBC anchor, and she is a big advocate of charter schools. She's got close ties to conservative politics. What role is Campbell Brown playing at Facebook?
So I think before we actually talk about specific people, I think the relationship that Facebook has with news has changed over the last few years. I mean, when Campbell Brown was brought in, it was actually at a time where Facebook was working very closely with newsrooms. It was actually paying some newsrooms to do Facebook Live videos. It was actually working with publishers to say, we want more of your content on our site. And then in the last year or so, we've seen this kind of shift to, actually, we're going to change the algorithm because we think people want more content from friends and family. And we've actually seen the relationship with the news media change slightly. So I think that's also something that we have to recognize, which is these platforms can't necessarily work out what their role is in the information ecosystem. And I think in the last year, they've recognized that publishing news is difficult. You know, ask any journalist about the decisions they have to make every single day about what to include, what we don't. Are we breaking the law? What other cultural implications do we need to think about? And I think Facebook in the last 2 years has had a bit of a shock, which is this stuff is difficult. And I think because of that, you know, they've obviously changed the algorithm a little bit. But they need journalists to think that they're doing a good job. You know, there are PR implications here, as we saw 2 weeks ago with the crash on Wall Street. There's money at stake here. There are PR implications. So I think, you know, somebody like Campbell Brown is trying to walk this fine line between working closely with publishers while at the same time recognizing that it's a difficult relationship.
Ryan, what can you tell us about Campbell Brown and her role at Facebook?
I'd agree that her role has changed. It's kind of funny watching Facebook change this approach. A year and a half ago, Facebook would have told you Facebook is not a media company. And that line has kind of been memed and talked about incessantly among journalists, because now you ask them if they're a media company and they kind of waffle on it. They're kind of less sure about themselves. And to the point about changing algorithms, there was a massive change recently with, at the beginning of the year, changing news content and dropping it from 5% in your newsfeed to 4%, which actually seems quite small, but it's a massive change for the amount of traffic that each individual publisher sees. And Facebook made that change with the idea of kind of getting more of your friend content onto the platform, kind of shifting away from published news, because they feel like people have kind of disengaged with the platform because they've seen so much news. And I think that's a significant change that we have to kind of pay attention to as the year goes on.
And let's talk about a meeting that's getting some attention. BuzzFeed's editor-in-chief, and Ryan, you're a reporter at BuzzFeed. Mm-hmm. BuzzFeed's editor-in-chief, Ben Smith, along with Lydia Polgreen, the editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, and Vox publisher Melissa Bell, objected to the conservative blog The Daily Caller and a few other publications being included in a partnership meeting between Facebook and news publishers. Ben Smith, BuzzFeed's editor-in-chief, reportedly said he does not object to conservative news outlets, just ones that do not qualify as journalism. So rather than deciding what journalism is, Facebook said it would rely on independent fact-checkers to decide what is true and what is not. Ryan, what do you think about that?
I think Ben, I should go and take a look at Ben's post on this. I think Ben believes that some of the outlets that were involved in that meeting kind of are bad faith actors in all this, and maybe don't report on things in a good faith kind of way. But I'd encourage you guys to go read Ben's post on that, because I don't want to speak for him.
Claire, what do you think of that meeting? And what came out of it?
I mean, this comes to the heart of all of this, which is, you know, these platforms want to be seen as neutral, and they just want to believe that they're kind of pipes and those information is flowing through the pipes. And of course, in the last few years, you've had people constantly saying, are you a publisher or are you a platform? And the truth is, they're actually somewhere in between. They're a hybrid. But the challenges that they're having here about who do we allow on our platform? I mean, yesterday they said InfoWars can no longer be on the platform. You know, we don't have a standard for journalism where, you know, Ryan doesn't have to have a badge that says I'm a professional journalism. Unlike doctors or lawyers, there isn't that kind of a standard around news organizations. And we've always said, well, that's fine, we don't need that. But in an age of misinformation, now increasingly you're seeing people say, but I want to demonstrate that we do actually have professional processes and standards, that we do have a corrections policy and an ethics policy. But there isn't any oversight in order to do that, which is why these platforms are now struggling to say, who do we let onto our platform and who don't we? I mean, I think around InfoWars, you know, Apple said that they were going to take InfoWars off. And then yesterday there was this domino effect of YouTube and Spotify and Facebook all saying the same thing. And so you can kind of say, well, okay, that maybe that makes sense in the US context, maybe. But then how do you scale that? How do you scale that to the Philippines and Brazil and Indonesia? How do you have those, you know, and where's the transparency that allows us to look at Facebook's decisions to see, okay, I understand why you're taking down InfoWars or why you're taking down this site in the Philippines. What's lacking is we don't have a process of transparency, that there isn't an ombudsman that I can call up and say, I think this is a problem. There isn't a process by which I can complain. And so instead they're making these decisions. I understand why they're under huge pressure, but I do worry about scale, and I worry about, again, these decisions have been taken, you know, at Facebook, but we don't necessarily understand why and what does that mean in the future, the decisions that are taken yesterday?
And just before we go to break, Ryan, what are your thoughts about the decision to remove InfoWars? This is the hard right conspiracy theorist show hosted by Alex Jones.
Right. I think you should note, actually, that InfoWars wasn't removed for false news. Facebook actually, as a platform, has said this. They allow people to post, publications to post false news. They'll just downrank it in the algorithm. So as we talk about false news here, it's actually important to note that InfoWars wasn't removed for false news, but rather for inciting kind of harassment on the platform. Ultimately, I think Facebook made the right decision. I don't think it was a very transparent one. They didn't kind of outline the process by which InfoWars got to the point where they had to be removed from the platform. But I think it was the right call, even though it came after Apple ultimately deplatformed InfoWars from the podcast app.
Ryan Mack is a senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed, and Dr. Claire Wardle is co-founder of First Draft. On today's Your Call, we are talking about how social media companies should deal with false news. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up, we will speak with journalist A.C. Thompson about the new PBS and ProPublica investigation called Documenting Hate, Charlottesville. It exposes how white supremacist groups continue to operate with impunity 1 year after the far-right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, turned deadly. 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed when an alleged white supremacist plowed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters. We're also putting a show together about a new documentary called Crime and Punishment. It looks at illegal policing quotas in New York City and chronicles the lives of a group of Black and Latino whistleblower police officers and the young people of color they say they're pressured to arrest and summons. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. On today's show, we are talking about how social media companies like Twitter and Facebook determine the kinds of news that we see and what they should do to prevent the rapid spread of false news with so much money at stake, or I should say at a time when so much money is at stake. We're talking about this with Dr. Claire Wardle, co-founder of First Draft, a nonprofit at the Harvard University Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. First Draft focuses on addressing misinformation and disinformation. Ryan Mack is a senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed News. And before we get to calls, Ryan, before the break, you said, so Facebook allows people to post false news. Can you elaborate on that? And how do they determine what is false news?
It's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it, actually. But yes, you can post mistruths, untruths, things you know are deliberately wrong to Facebook. It's not against Facebook's policies to do that. And over the last couple months, Facebook has had to kind of clearly define that policy. Now, what will happen is if when you do that, let's say an organization posts a story that's wrong, a fact checker will come in, they will downrank that story, and the algorithm will then hopefully prevent the spread of that piece from going out to people's news feeds. But posting false news in and of itself is not a violation of any Facebook terms of service.
Wow. Claire, what about that? Is this odd, unusual?
Well, it's funny we're having this conversation. You might be able to tell from my accent that I am not from these shores. I'm from Europe, where in Europe, people are much more likely to believe that that kind of publishing should be not allowed. But in the US, of course, because of the First Amendment, once you start thinking about this is legal speech, I mean, does this mean that you would have to not allow The Onion to post? I mean, when things are really 100% false, it seems really complicated to think, really, Facebook lets that go up. But the truth is that it's very rare that we have things that are that clearly untrue. Most of the stuff that we're talking about is somewhere in the middle. It's the gray area. And so it's very difficult to think about that. So actually, I understand where Facebook are coming from, which is to say, if we had to make this line, who would moderate that? Who would make those decisions every single day about whether something is true or not? So I think what they're trying to do with fact checkers is a way of saying, we're not going to be the arbiters of truth. We're going to work with fact checkers. And actually, we'll never take it fully off the platform. But our hope is that we will take it off or we'll downrank it so much that only people who spend all day on Facebook will see it. But this is a very challenging space. And it's something that globally, many different publishers are struggling with.
Well, let's hear from a listener. Let's go to Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Big fan of the show. So two quick, simple questions. One is, for people who are, it seems like in the Bay Area, especially, we're very socially connected and politically progressive, but I find it odd when people go onto Facebook to decry Facebook. Doesn't it seem like it kind of defeats the purpose? How do you communicate the challenges that Facebook presents to people using it, who that's the only way they communicate? I happen to be on Facebook. I never post anything, but that's the only way I can communicate with some people because they don't respond to email or phone calls. My other question is the ubiquitousness of Facebook. There is no challenger. There's no Coke or Pepsi with Facebook. It's Facebook or nothing. I'm wondering what the guests think about the idea of regulating Facebook like utility, because for some people, they can't really live without it. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Good. Great points, Peter. Thank you. Ryan, do you want to take that first?
I think that question was about finding an alternative to Facebook or being obsessed with Facebook. I think it's funny because I'm on Twitter, and reporters and people that are always on Twitter often complain about Twitter on Twitter, and it's kind of that same effect. But yeah, I mean, to your point about being on Facebook because it's the only place you can communicate with people, I feel the same way with family members, with relatives abroad. Sometimes Facebook is the best method, and that's why the platform is so sticky. I mean, there's no other place you can go to talk to some of these people, to see some of these things, and that's why it's captured more than 2 billion users at this point.
What do you think about Peter's question? Could Facebook be regulated like a public utility since it is so ubiquitous?
It's a favorite argument of folks like Steve Bannon. I think he's made that point one of his kind of rallying cries in terms of attacking Silicon Valley. I think it would be very difficult. It would be very challenging. And I don't know where you'd see the kind of government impetus to do so. I mean, it would kind of contradict a lot of the conservative right's kind of move towards allowing kind of corporate freedom, I guess. And I think it would just be very tough to do so.
What are your thoughts, Claire?
So as a European, I actually think that we might see some movement in Europe first, although I have to say the conversation in the US in the last 6 months has been quite surprising to me. And I think we've seen more serious conversations about potential regulation. My fear about regulation is we know so little about this problem that we shouldn't be having, you know, we really shouldn't be thinking about regulation until we understand the problem. So I actually think if there's anything government could do, it could be putting pressure on the platforms to open up some of their data to actually allow people to recognize, well, what does it mean? We're all of us on this call on Facebook, but our experience of Facebook is completely unique, dependent on our friends and what they post, etc. So it's impossible for us to really understand what people are seeing on their Facebook feeds. And there are many other social media platforms that are the same. So what I would like to see is government say, you are ubiquitous. Your influence on public discussion and people's access to information is now greater than almost any other platform or form of information. Therefore, you have a responsibility to allow us as society to judge whether or not the information flowing through your platform is having an impact on society. And we can't research that unless we have access to your data. And of course, they're going to throw their hands up and say, well, look at Cambridge Analytica. You don't want us to have the data. But we have auditing of financial markets. There are mechanisms by which I think we can have trusted partners who can therefore have access to people's data that's anonymous, that's anonymized, so, you know, there's no privacy concerns. But I think we have to have a starting point to understand what the impact of these algorithms are. They're never going to open up their algorithmic black boxes, but we should understand what the impact of those algorithms are on the information that people see on their smartphones every day.
And I'd agree with that actually as well. And I think there's a lot of steps to take before you actually get to a full regulation of something as a public good. I think Europe is taking a couple steps with GDPR, as Claire mentioned. And yeah, I just don't see a case where it would be like a public utility, like your water service or your gas line or something. But we'll see.
What data do you think the government should have access to? Because executives from Facebook, Twitter, and Google are supposedly going to testify, this is according to BuzzFeed, it says likely testify before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence next month. This is according to the committee chair, Richard Burr. And when Mark Zuckerberg testified at a joint hearing of the Senate Commerce and Judiciary Committee in April, you know, a number of people said it was clear that politicians really don't understand technology and they really want to gain points by talking mostly about Russian interference in the election. But Claire, when you have these high-level execs testify in front of the Senate committee, what questions do you think politicians should ask?
So I think it was quite difficult to watch that testimony because Mark Zuckerberg had obviously done a lot of preparation. And so when he was asked questions, he was walking a very fine line. And so I'm obviously in groups of people who think about this a lot. And in those closed groups, people are like, oh, God, I can't believe there needs to be a follow-up question. And I think actually we need to have more digital marketing experts actually briefing some of these senators and congressmen. So I think there's an element there is in order to ask the right questions and to ask the follow-up questions, you need to be very knowledgeable about these platforms and how they work. And they're actually pretty complex. You know, people who do this for a living will talk about a whole host of things. I'm like, can you explain that again? So I'm not blaming politicians for not having the right answer, the right questions, but I do think we should be doing a better job of actually briefing them in the first place so we can hold these executives to account, because it is possible to look like you're answering the question, but you're not really.
Ryan, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, that was frustrating to watch as a reporter. I mean, he was questioned for almost, I think, 11 hours total between the House and the Senate, and it didn't feel like anyone landed a significant question. Now, the September hearing, which has been confirmed, it'll feature Twitter's CEO Jack Dorsey, Facebook's COO Sheryl Sandberg, and I believe they want Google CEO Sundar Pichai. to testify. That one's going to be a little more focused and focus on kind of the Russia investigation as well. So I think the Intelligence Committee will be a little more informed and a little more focused in that case.
Ryan Mack is a senior tech reporter with BuzzFeed, and Dr. Claire Wardle is co-founder of First Draft, a nonprofit at the Harvard University Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. First Draft focuses on addressing misinformation and disinformation. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about how companies like Twitter and Facebook determine the kind of news we see. What are they doing about all of the false news that is spreading so rapidly when a lot of money is at stake? Again, Facebook's mobile advertising revenue grew to almost $12 billion, up 50% over last year. And Motley Crue reports that Twitter's growth accelerated in the second quarter to about $100 million in profit. So we're talking about a lot of money here. What are your thoughts on this? I'm sorry, Motley Fool, not the band Motley Crue.
I love the band.
Actually, I do too. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. How do you think this issue should be tackled? And if you have any questions at all about what you see and how these companies, what role they play in all of this, we'd love to hear from you. Now, this is where it's so difficult to talk about some of these issues because there's so many layers to this. When you look at how people in other countries are spreading false news, can you give us a sense of how widespread this is and how concerned we should be? Because, of course, every day we hear about Russian influence on the election. There have been a lot of really great reports looking at that. There was another report, The Guardian, BuzzFeed, Wired. They looked at the Macedonian town of 55,000. Let me get the name of this town. I'll get that name in a second. But it was the registered home of at least 100 pro-Trump websites, many of them filled with utterly fake news. Okay, Claire, we're getting so much information about how so much fake news was spread from different parts of the world. We hear constantly about Russia. Since you follow this so closely, how pervasive is this and how concerned should we be about it?
So this is absolutely a global phenomenon, and I'm pleased that we're talking about it because it tends to, in the US, be focused on political disinformation. It tends to be focused on the election and Russia, and it tends to be focused on Facebook. And actually, if we look globally, this is a huge challenge. And actually, in many parts of the world, it's actually misinformation about science and health. It's about dividing different ethnic and religious groups. And this is happening almost entirely on closed messaging apps like WhatsApp, because we have communities there who've never had an email address and people are going straight to their smartphones and they're using something like WhatsApp. And so when you study those kind of spaces, what you see is a very different type of misinformation. But it's the same. It's people trying to drive wedges in communities. It's about in-group and out-group. It's about fear. It's about those very human attributes. So when we look globally at this problem, it's quite different to the US. And the question is, what we're seeing in places like India or Asia Pacific or Brazil, are they ahead of the curve when it comes to some of this? Or actually, is it just slightly different? So on one level, misinformation and disinformation everywhere, but there are different patterns when you look globally.
And the town I was looking for is called Veles. It's in Macedonia, an unlikely home for dozens of pro-Trump political news sites. And the headlines are Hillary's illegal email just killed its first American spy? This is how liberals destroyed America. This is why we need Trump in the White House. It goes on and on. Ryan, what are your thoughts? How pervasive is this false news coming from places overseas, and how concerned should we be about it?
I think we should be very concerned. I mean, in those cases in the Macedonian town, I think that case has been covered by my colleague Craig Silverman a lot. In those cases, those are foreign actors trying to kind of pollute the social discourse of American politics and American political discussion. I think that's something to be extremely worried about, that someone can game the platform like that and get in front of American voters and American readers. In the other cases, I think that's an extreme, which is the point with what Claire said about messaging apps. That's also a very extremely massive problem. You've got issues of kind of genocide in Myanmar being promoted through Facebook Messenger. I mean, and these things can spread virally. So often what we'll see is a message, a faked image, or a misleading image with some kind of misleading text that leads to a village being burned down in Myanmar. In Brazil, you have kind of anti-vaccination pushes on WhatsApp. And the thing with WhatsApp is these messages are often encrypted, so you don't know the sourcing of them. You can't trace them. They're often easily forwarded to your friend group or your social group. And so that's another kind of facet of fake news or false news that's a massive problem on a global scale. And I think you'll see a lot more of these issues come to head in the coming years.
Yeah, and it's one thing to be bombarded with false news and, you know, maybe your relative brings this information to the dinner table and you have to say, okay, let's look at this. Where are you getting this information? But it's another thing altogether when you're talking about people's lives. People can possibly lose their lives over this information.
Yeah, and what you really want to understand is that in a lot of these cases, in a lot of these countries, Facebook is the internet for these people. Facebook, yeah. WhatsApp, this is the means of communication. They've known nothing else. And so when you rely on that, and that's your whole world, your whole online world, you're going to believe it when you see it. And that's a massive issue.
And I think also Claire? To say many of these communities are much that their experience of the internet has just been the last few years. So talking about they've jumped over email. Somebody the other day sent me a lot of WhatsApp messages from Nigeria, and I read them, and they looked like terrible spam emails that we would get in 2002. And what we forget is that we've actually learned a great deal in the last 20 years about how to make sense of information we receive online. And so communities who this is much newer to them, we actually have to recognize how can we teach people how to make sense of that information. And as Ryan says, is if it comes to you on WhatsApp on your phone, you don't know what the source of the information is, but it has been shared with you by your best friend or your mum, and so you're just automatically much more likely to believe it. So that's the challenge we have in communities that have lower levels of digital literacy and a complete absence of those mental shortcuts we were talking about earlier, which makes people pretty confused about the sourcing of the information and whether or not they can trust it.
And Claire, for people who are not familiar with WhatsApp, it essentially serves as a sort of a texting platform, right? You can exchange messages in different parts of the world for free.
Yeah, it's just like SMS, but in many places it relies on data, so you can use Wi-Fi connections to send messages. So in communities where people didn't want to use up their data, they could go to a cafe and through Wi-Fi they could suddenly text with their friends. But when you look at this, a lot of it is images and a lot of it is just, they look like long text messages. Sometimes people will take a screenshot of a news article and share it on WhatsApp because they don't want to have to click on a URL and actually go out to the internet because that costs more data. So it's a fascinating ecosystem. And when you understand how people use it, you recognize that a big part of this is communities who are much more, the internet for them is new and exciting, but they haven't necessarily got the skills to understand how you make sense of that information.
Your organization, Claire, First Draft, recently helped launch Comprova, which is a project bringing together journalists from 24 different Brazilian media companies. And the goal is to identify and explain rumors, fabricated content, and manipulation tactics that might influence the 2018 presidential election in Brazil. Tell us about this project.
So we wanted to study Brazil because in many ways it mirrors the US. It's actually more polarized than the US, but has very high levels of WhatsApp usage. And so we wanted to understand what was happening in Brazil. So what we recognize is that in order to reach large numbers of Brazilians, we needed the help of existing news outlets rather than starting something new. So we have 24 of the biggest Brazilian news outlets working together. So they are collaborating, which is kind of amazing for the news industry. The news industry is normally very competitive. But what we have is a number of different journalists from different news outlets working together to find and then verify information that's circulating online. And then they're publishing on a site and they're putting their logos together next to one another. So you need three different news organizations to agree with the idea of helping to build trust with audiences. And this is designed to work in a mobile environment. So it's a very lightweight website. And we're working very closely with WhatsApp in order to push out these debunks to the widest possible audience in Brazil.
Wow. How's it going so far?
It's day two. We've posted two reports. But it's exciting. I mean, we have a WhatsApp number that people are sending requests in. People are sending things in that they're seeing in their WhatsApp groups. Because as Ryan said, the challenge is, as journalists, we can't see what's circulating in these closed message spaces. So we need to rely on the audience to send in these tips to say, well, my best friend Barry just sent this. Do I trust it? And so they will send it in, then we'll debunk it and then push it out publicly on our website. So I'll let you know in a couple of weeks how we're doing.
Well, Claire, what would you say to people who are overwhelmed by all of this, but realize how important it is? I mean, just what you said about how people overseas rely so much on WhatsApp or on Facebook as their main communication tool. I mean, it's easy for us to say, well, just shut it down. But for a lot of people, this is how they communicate. So what can people do who want to, you know, get involved in this, pressure the companies, try to limit the amount of fake news or false news that's being spread?
So I think the key here is making everybody realize that whilst we have these free communication devices, if I publish something on Facebook, actually, there's a responsibility that goes with publishing. And anybody who works as a journalist understands that. But they have ethics training. They have legal training. They understand the responsibility that comes with publishing. I think the mistake that we made was that we got very excited about all being able to share with our friends and family or more broadly. And we didn't say there was responsibility there. And I think globally, as a society, we have to say, if we want to take seriously the information that's flowing across these platforms, we have to hold each other to account. So A, we have to make sure that we're not sharing false or misleading information. And if we see Crazy Uncle Bob sharing false or misleading information, we have to call Bob out and say, actually, we don't want to live in a place where we have polluted information highways. It's a bit like we shouldn't be throwing, you know, Coca-Cola cans out of the car window, and we hold each other to account. So whilst, yes, the platforms have to take responsibility for this, and there are technical fixes that we should think through, I would love to see more kind of public information awareness campaigns about we all have to take responsibility for the information we share and hold each other to account.
And it makes me think about people in school right now, you know, young people who are growing up with this social media, and media literacy is just so, so important.
Yes, but we also have to be careful that we don't drive down trust, because we're seeing some research findings now that we've done such a good job of telling students, you know, be careful what you find online, that they're now not trusting anything, whether it's, you know, BBC, NPR or Wikipedia. So there's a fine line here about how we make sure that people are skeptical. And a lot of things I think we need to teach are emotional skepticism. And Craig Silverman from BuzzFeed has talked about this for a while, which is teaching people, which is if a piece of information you find makes you feel angry or smug, then that's more likely that your brain will not be as critical as it needs to be. So we do need to look at our media literacy curriculum, and we need to think, are we teaching people how to stop and think? And they need to be doing that when they actually have an emotional reaction to a piece of information.
Ryan, what would you add just about how people can get involved and do something to minimize the amount of false information that's being spread?
I think I want to take it back real quick, but you mentioned something that was really interesting where people start not to care. And I've talked to a lot of researchers about this. Aviv Avadja is one of them, who has this term kind of called information apathy, where you read so much, you're told everything is false, that you just stop caring about everything. And I think that's a massive kind of dangerous place to be at when you're kind of social populace doesn't care about the information it's receiving, doesn't have the willingness to kind of discern what's real and what's not. What people can do at this point, I think it's just being more a little more skeptical about everything you read online. To Craig's point about if something makes you feel a certain way, you should go back and kind of see where that's coming from, understand where you're getting your news, and just being a little that much more skeptical, I think, will help people kind of understand the world a little better, I guess.
And Ryan, you recently covered Facebook's removal of pages and accounts that were engaged in, quote, coordinated inauthentic behavior, end quote. And some of this came from Russian state-sponsored actors. As you wrote, at least 290,000 users followed one or more of the 32 pages and accounts that were removed from Facebook and Instagram. Just because so much of the media focus is on Russia, And a lot of politicians, especially Democrats, are saying that, you know, people from Russia are going to get involved in the 2018 midterm elections, and they're going to try to influence people by using social media. How truthful do you think that is? And how concerned should we be? Just like we were talking about what was happening in Macedonia, how concerned should we be about what's coming out of Russia?
I think Facebook actually hasn't definitively tied that to Russia, but I think what a lot of the techniques that were used were similar to what we saw in the 2016 election with Russian state actors. But to your point about kind of what can we do, I think you just got to expect. I mean, these platforms are going to get gamed in a certain way by bad actors. I think it's Facebook's job to kind of lessen that as much as possible, but. Sometimes it's almost impossible to tell what's real and what's not. I mean, in the case of one of these pages that was taken down by Facebook, it had created an event that's actually happening, that was supposed to happen this weekend in Washington, D.C. It was an administrator of a page that created a protest event that people actually ended up, real people ended up kind of RSVPing to and saying they were going to attend. So it's quite hard for the individual person to kind of discern these things. I think it's on the platforms to kind of understand and better kind of suss these things out.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. Ryan Mack is a senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed News, and you can find his reports at yourcallradio.org. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Claire Wardle is co-founder of First Draft, a nonprofit at the Harvard University's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, and they focus on addressing misinformation and disinformation. Claire, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow on Your Call, we will speak with journalist A.C. Thompson about the new PBS and ProPublica investigation documenting hate Charlottesville. It exposes how white supremacist groups continue to operate with impunity. Last year, a far-right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, turned deadly after 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed when an alleged white supremacist plowed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters. That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced to KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter to find out what's coming up at Your Call Radio. And you can email show ideas and let us know what you think of the show, yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.